On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have to talk about Equifax again. The FCC thinks that you want lower broadband standards and your network will be automated. Will you be ready? Twite on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 258, recorded September 22nd, 2017. InfoBlocks on Change Management. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballister, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise, but I can't guide you by myself. It's an awfully big networked world. I'm going to need a little help from my friends, starting with Mr. Lou Maresco, who has officially, folks, been promoted to senior booth babe at Microsoft. He'll be at Ignite next week. Lou, are you all packed, ready to go?
Oh, yeah. Packed, ready to go. Looking, hopefully there's no hurricanes down there, and hopefully have a good week.
Everything I'm reading says this is going to be a good Ignite. There's some big announcements that Microsoft's ready to make. You can't talk about it, but we're definitely going to have to cover it next week. Now, will you be meeting up with Paul and Mary Jo while you're there?
Absolutely. I'm going to try to get to some of the little events they're doing. It looks like they're doing some commentation and also the meetup too on Monday night.
Fantastic. Well, Lou, we look forward to many pictures and videos, maybe even a couple of streams of your time in Florida. Now, someone else who feels like he's in Florida because he's melting currently is Mr. Brian Chi. He is the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. And Brian, from the fan and the rivers of sweat running down your face, I'm assuming that your air conditioner is not fixed yet, yes?
No, this is me not making enough time to clean up so we can get the air conditioner lift in here. Now, I do want to do a shout out and say thank you very much to the CentOS team. CentOS version 7 now has a way to do security updates without updating the entire machine. So that way you don't go and hork your packages, which is very, very, very cool. And you know what? That might have saved Equifax.
Well, we say saved Equifax with a lot of quotations and question marks.
We'll
get to that. Folks, we've got a great show for you. Not only was there quite a bit of news in the network world this week, but we've also got a representative from InfoBlocks to come on and tell you a little bit about network automation. If you want to make your job easier, you're going to want to stay tab. But first, as we always do, we have to jump into the blips. Now, 1 week, perhaps soon, there will be no head-smacking, jaw-dropping, curse-inducing foul-up by Equifax. This is not that week. Since discovering on September 8th that Equifax waited a month and a half to tell us that half of all adults in the United States had incredibly sensitive information stolen from their servers, it has been discovered that, in order, their information and network security executives had no experience with information or network security. The first breach actually happened in March, not July. Their credit freeze page allows anybody with the data from the breach to unfreeze your credit. And just yesterday, Equifax owned up to the fact that it had been sending potentially affected users to the wrong site, possibly a phishing site, for 2 weeks. With their CEO being called before Congress, the FTC and SEC investigating irregular trades and potential harm to financial institutions, and a class action lawsuit of epic proportions building, Equifax would have been in a heap of trouble even without any of the self-inflicted gunshots. Still, there is an open question of whether or not anything can really be done to punish such an incompetent handling of our data and a worse-than-ham-fisted response to the consequences of that incompetence. Maybe we won't have to talk about Equifax next week.
Nah, doubt it. So I would like to make an apology for some of the cracks I made in previous weeks about the Houston data centers. Seems those boys were really prepared. So I was saying, yeah, some of these guys might be dark. Well, seems they stocked up on everything. I mean, really everything, right down to officially making a policy for the worker families to bring their families, their kids, their solstices into the safe rooms. Another example of extreme prepping is up and down the Florida panhandle. There are some weird pyramid structures that, according to Kurt, are AT&T telecom centers, where workers are actually encouraged to bring their families there during disasters so that they actually show up instead of taking care of their people. You know, it makes sense, right? You know, I'll choose my family over work anytime. Though I am still wondering how the fiber optic trunk cables are going to be doing after being submerged for several weeks. But the network maps seem to be normalizing, with Houston no longer a dark spot. Funny thing. Seems they did forget one thing, which is apparently being solved right now. Well, washer and dryer.
So this past week, nonprofits and large conglomerates alike got together for a vote. And this wasn't just any vote. This one was going basically essentially trying to shape how the industry uses the web from years to come. The World Wide Web Consortium, or W3C, met this past week to go over a standard called the Encrypted Media Extensions, or EME. And what's the skinny about this standard? Well, it essentially standardizes on a portion of the delivery method of copyright video. The consortium was aiming to remove the need for third-party extensions like Flash and Silverlight to ensure their viewers can watch copyright material without them. The transition is not new. It's essentially coming back from 2012, but this vote sets it essentially in stone. Corporations like Netflix say it will make the web more secure, more open, and more accessible. But there's several opponents, like Tim Wee, Net Neutrality Father, says it won't. To show just how controversial it was from the mix of academia, nonprofits, and large corporations, 108 votes said yes, 57 objected, 20 abstained, and around 278 didn't even participate. Doesn't that sound bad? Well, it doesn't sound that bad. Well, the EFF actually resigned from the foundation in protest, and also a staff member, Harry Halpin, resigned because of the vote outcome. Why? Well, they're worried that big business is influencing votes, and the W3C is known for ensuring that no one member has more influence than the next, but of course, there's always other sides of the views where you know multiple corporations are coming in and they're putting their own agendas. DRM was the first pass of tightening the copyright side of video. EME is just the next generation. Since conditions in the real world require such a technology and standard, it's pushed over the top and to the standard. This may be why electric vehicles and autonomous vehicles and technology is the next big thing. Think about that.
Public cloud, private cloud, on-premise hybrid deployment. For several years now, we've had several great options for infrastructure build-out that let us create just the right balance of dynamic resource availability, data security, scalability, efficiency, and affordability. However, it seems that the cloud may have finally won over some of the most die-hard premise-only critics. According to a Synergy Research study, spending on traditional premise-based data center hardware dropped 18% between the second quarters of 2015 and 2017, while spending over the same period rose 16%, for private or hybrid cloud, and a whopping 35% for pure public cloud. This happened as the overall market for data center equipment rose 5% to more than $30 billion. Not surprisingly, the main players for on-premise, Microsoft, Dell, HPE, and Cisco, are also the main players for cloud-based services, so we can expect more and more of our biggest providers to push for a cloud-first strategy.
So can we say that we're piling on to Kaspersky? You know, you got to feel bad for Kaspersky. They even offered to open up their source code to prove they aren't really an organ of the Soviet secret police. This following on the heels of the U.S. Department of Defense banning Kaspersky products from any DoD system and the U.S. Senate voting for it to ban U.S. government wide. So while I'm certain there's been some mistrust in the past, I have to admit that opening source code should be good enough, considering this is exactly what China and Europe have demanded of Microsoft.
If you're a non-believer of mixed reality or even augmented reality technologies like HoloLens, then Ford Motor Company might be able to help you decide that it's worth something to designers and engineers alike. Physical models are hard, even with 3D printing them, but if designers could see their designs at full scale, as if they were in front of them, then things could potentially change. Why? Well, imagine creating your design using mixed reality and then moving through the different design flows and shapes and materials, augmenting them and using existing vehicle chassis. Then you can literally get to test them in a simulator. It would ensure faster iterations on designs and the ability to share those designs with other groups, teams, and stakeholders. You could produce your design, comment on the intentions behind it while you're building it out, and then actually share that with the other stakeholders. This is the first time that we're seeing this type of thing, especially using HoloLens in developing cars. But it's not the first time we've seen VR in that. Tesla's competitor Lucid uses HTC's Vive as VR to design their vehicles that are soon to debut. Ford's new process is going to be a global rollout to ensure the next generation of its vehicles use every single consideration in the design and development phase. It can mean you may be able to design your own vehicle in the coming years.
Now, AMD has already gathered an incredible amount of mindshare with their Ryzen architecture, forcing suppliers to rethink their designs and Intel to drop prices. Now it looks like they've got another incredible win with Tesla. On Wednesday, the electric car manufacturer revealed that they've received their first batch of custom silicon for handling autonomous driving tasks in its automobiles. This is part of Tesla's push to own their core technologies and to be vertically integrated to the point that they can develop all the tech needed for the last big push to completely autonomous driving. To that end, Tesla partnered with AMD to create more power-efficient, purpose-built chips on top of AMD's technology. And at the facility of GlobalFoundries, with which AMD has a wafer supply agreement through 2020. This is especially noteworthy as Tesla's current provider of silicon is NVIDIA, which is in direct competition with AMD, and both of the latter companies are making a case for their architectures in cloud-based computing. Now, surprise, we've got a bonus breaking blip for you, and that's all about the FCC. Now, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai has a plan for stimulating the growth of broadband deployment in the United States, and that plan is to drop the definition of broadband from 25 to 10 megabits per second and to include wireless coverage as broadband deployment. In its 2017 inquiry, the FCC suggested that ISPs might not have to deploy to rural and poor connective areas as they have in exchange for right-of-way agreements and as provisos in their various mergers and acquisitions, because wireless service is so ubiquitous. One problem: the previous FCC defined 25 megabits per second as broadband, and none of those rural areas support that speed in wireless. So, Chairman Pai and the Republican members of the FCC have suggested that we simply drop the standard of broadband to 10 megabits per second. The inquiry was filled with the same good-for-the-consumer language that was found in their defense of dropping the requirements for ISPs to inform consumers that they'd be selling private data. For the life of me, I'm not sure how allowing ISPs to continue to have near monopolies in the market is good for consumers if they're not also required to fulfill their contracts to deploy to lesser served areas. On a historical note, this isn't the first time that this has happened. Back in the 90s, the telcos accepted $200 billion-plus in incentives in exchange for delivering 45 megabit per second synchronous broadband connections to 86 million Americans. What they delivered was 1.5 megabits per second DSL to about 11 million Americans. We're still paying for that broken promise. Do we really want to allow for another? That does it for the blips. Let's go ahead and jump into the bites. And this one, well, it could be a tiny bit political, but it's important because this is all about how we deal with damages in a cyber world. Now, in January of 2017, the FTC filed suit against D-Link after the network equipment manufacturer's devices were taken over for use in several high-profile internet attacks. The FTC alleged that D-Link shirked its responsibilities by making patently false advertising claims about security, exposing its private key, allowing malware to be signed by D-Link, falsely promising to immediately respond to instances of unauthorized access, and a host of other gobsmackingly bad actions. Specifically, the FTC filed six charges. First, unfairness, that D-Link didn't take reasonable steps to secure their software. Two, security response misrepresentations, that D-Link falsely claimed that they would take steps to secure their products. Three, router promotional misrepresentations, that D-Link claimed their devices were secure. Four, IP camera promotional misrepresentations, that D-Link claimed their cams were secure. Five, router GUI misrepresentations, that D-Link claimed their router software was secure and responsive. And six, IP camera misrepresentations, that D-Link camera was secure and maintained. Now, for many, this was a much-deserved slap against D-Link and a warning to all manufacturers that they would be held to account for not securing devices in an increasingly device-dependent world. After all, some of the vulnerabilities that were exploited in D-Link's gear have existed for more than a decade. However, here comes the switch. On Wednesday, U.S. District Court Judge James Donato, one of the Northern District of California judges, dismissed three of the six charges. First, unfairness. The fourth one, IP camera promotional misrepresentations. And the fifth one, router GUI misrepresentations. Now, his argument is that while lax security was, quote, an annoyance and an inconvenience, unquote, the FTC had not actually provided specific examples of financial harm done to consumers. Chibert, I want to throw this to you first, and let's not go knee-jerk just yet. We can rant a little bit later, but for many people, the importance of this case was that it could be a signal to the entire industry that security is not an add-on. It has to be an essential feature if you're going to sell your device in a world where it's going to be connected to the public internet all the time. What's your first response to the fact that half of the lawsuit has now been thrown out?
I think that's horrible. I think some of these pieces that were thrown out are because they're just not reported. Let's just look at some of them. When residents get break-ins, you know, someone breaks into your home network, does something nefarious and so forth. Maybe you don't get your bills out on time and you have to pay late charges and things like that. The chances of that getting reported is close to zero. Why? Because almost none of the local police departments will actually treat that as a crime. If you call them up, maybe a detective will show up. Maybe a patrolman will show up. Maybe they'll even write a report. No. When Oliver Rist, one of our best buddies and pals, actually had his laptop stolen, and while we're trying to close down the credit cards, all of a sudden, you know, he started seeing nefarious charges. That is pretty clear cut, but yet the cops did nothing. They said, no, you haven't proved a big enough loss. That, I think, is the crux of the problem. People aren't reporting it. People aren't willing to go through the hassle because the cops aren't willing. If law enforcement actually started doing something about it, I got a sneaky hunch there's going to be an absolute flood of people reporting. But residents don't want to do it because the cops aren't doing anything.
Yeah, and you know, we have said that the judge did mention that the primary problem with all the charges that the FTC has brought against D-Link, not just the three that were dismissed, is the fact that you can't calculate damages. They didn't calculate damages. They brought up a bunch of things that look bad. It looks really bad that D-Link had vulnerabilities that they knew about for 10 years. It looks really bad that D-Link had hard-coded default username and passwords. It looks really bad that D-Link's devices were marketed as secure and the Internet of Things ready to go, when in reality, they weren't ready for anything. I mean, they had no security baked into them whatsoever, and no effective security, that is. But in our court system, if you're going to do this, you do have to prove damages. And it's not enough to say, well, there were tens of millions of devices that were affected. There were tens of millions of devices that were potentially taken over. It's not enough even to say, well, we know that a couple of D-Link devices took part in a few DDoS attacks, and they were most likely owned and used in a botnet. You have to be able to say there's a dollar amount attached, because that's how the law works. But Lou, let me throw this over to you. Does that mean the law is incredibly outdated here? Because, I mean, how do you tally up damages that could be a few cents, but a few cents over tens or hundreds of millions of users?
Yeah, I don't think it's flawed. I think there's the portion where you have to not only prove damages, but you also have to prove that you were aware that you were causing those damages too. Right. So there's a kind of a portion of that there is that, you know, D-Link put these products out, and, you know, they can claim that, hey, we thought that they were secure. You know, there might be some vulnerabilities in there, but we didn't think we were vulnerable to them until somebody told us. And now you're telling us, and now we're aware, and now we're going to go fix it. So I think there's a little bit of that as well. And so I think You know, to be able to prove damages, you could probably do that. I mean, sort of corporations could say, you know, or people could say, I was using these things, and because they were flawed and they were taken over, I've lost money because of them, or I've lost my privacy or whatnot. And then, you know, have a class action around those specific scenarios. But again, I don't think it will stick until they can prove the other side of things as well.
Right. It seems that the burden of proof for the FTC, which does not have a lot of manpower, is really too much for them to effectively bring a suit against a manufacturer like D-Link. I mean, remember, D-Link, honestly, it's a little low-hanging fruit here. They could go after Cisco. They could go after Microsoft. They could go after any vendor that sells hardware gear that has been owned in the past and used to create a botnet, because that's essentially what they're saying. They're saying that creating an insecure device allows attackers to use it to do nefarious things. That part we all get. If you're watching this show, you understand that. That's a basic fact of living in a connected world. However, in this courtroom, and Chibert, I want to throw this over to you. In this courtroom, you have to be able to put a dollar amount on that. And you have to say, okay, well, 5 million of these devices were D-Link, and we could tell that from their MAC addresses. And we know that they generated this much traffic, and that traffic interrupted these providers, and these providers say that that downtime cost them X amount of money. That's what you need to be able to do damages. Now, I made it sound simple, but that's actually incredibly hard to get affidavits and to have everyone sign off to say, yes, this is what actually happened. Does that put too much of a burden of proof on a prosecutor who's really, I think all of us can agree, was trying to do a good thing? It would be a great thing if all the manufacturers realized that they will be held account if they make shoddy gear and software.
You know, there was actually an effort. The industry itself was saying, you know, the government's not going to do anything, or the government can't do anything, or the government doesn't have enough resources to do anything. Let's go and turn this model upside down. We were actually looking at building an institute that strictly concentrated on security devices. InfraWorld Magazine, long, long, long time ago, we did all these bake-offs. We called them shootouts because we can't use the word bake-off. And we literally shamed the hardware manufacturers into building better gear, or at least making claims that were more realistic. And we would go and publish the results, and if you made really junk equipment, you would get publicly shamed in print. The interesting thing, though, the ad money to back that up and pay for all that dried up. So originally, I did 4 firewalls, and it was groundbreaking. And then no more. We were originally planning to do every firewall on the market and grade them. Was this collusion? Was this something else? I don't know. But there were certainly efforts. And JJ, no, I can't really do donations because these tests are wicked, wicked expensive.
Right.
Could it happen someday? Maybe. Should it happen someday with the blessing of, say, like the National Institute of Standards and Technology? Yeah, I think it should. But I think it's going to take a large hue and cry from the general public to say enough is enough. Fix this.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to take a lot of letter writing, a lot of emails, a lot of telegrams and so forth. And you're going to have to tell Congress that you've had it. You've had it. You know, cases like D-Link need to stop happening, and the general public needs to go and vote with their dollars.
Chibert, I'm glad that you brought that up because you do have a very unique experience in doing that. You work for a publication that for many, many years was the watchdog. It was the publication that said, okay, look, all these manufacturers make gear that say they could do this. So we tested them against those claims, just what they said they could do. And you often found, in way more than one case, that the gear came nowhere near what they said it could do. The capabilities just weren't there. There were always the standouts, and that's why it was nice to be able to do those kinds of bake-offs or shootouts or whatever we're going to call them so that we don't get into trouble. But the problem is that that testing was supported by the very same companies that were getting shot out or baked off. And that wasn't sustainable. And so those people who are saying, well, this shouldn't be the government making this lawsuit, it should be the industry, that's always going to be a problem. If the industry is not going to want to uncover its own dirty secrets, someone has to do it, some organization. Now, one other note before I throw back to Lou, because Lou has a interesting point about this turning into a civil thing. It would be very easy to make fun of the judge, to say the judge doesn't understand technology. However, Judge Donato has a remarkably consistent record in cases of this type. He is popular for demanding that the plaintiffs show actual damage. In July of 2016, he demanded that a class action against Niantic by a group that was claiming that their property was damaged because people kept wandering on to catch Pokemon and flip Fortles. He said, well, show me the actual damage. Give me an estimate of the damage. You can't just claim $5 million in damages without showing me $5 million of damage. In March of 2017, he demanded that Telesocial prove damages from an alleged hack by Orange. Of course, that suit had to be dropped out because they couldn't do it. It was all theoretical. In June of 2015, he basically neutered OpenText's suit against Box because OpenText's damage expert lacked, quote, quantifiable support, unquote, to prove any damage from the alleged infringements. And remember, this works both ways. We've covered cases here in which researchers have been brought to court by organizations saying they caused this amount of damage by sending an email, or they caused this amount of damage by using an exploit to get into my network, or by using my horribly set up security to access an email account. Judge Donato is the judge you want for those cases, because he will demand, well, show me how you actually came to that damage figure. So you can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, we need to actually quantify damages when it's in our favor, but we don't want to quantify damages when it's not. Lou, what's a better way to handle this? As Chibert said, it might come down to us voting with our dollars, but maybe there's another option than allowing the FTC, which is incredibly understaffed, to take the bullet.
When you bring in consumers or corporations alike and they go against a company and they, you know, like you said, you can't potentially prove negligence from the FTC standpoint. And again, because of the resources. But if a company or a consumer alike comes and says and tries to prove damages, there's a more likely chance that would force change. And what that would mean is they don't necessarily have to prove that this corporation knew about it. It's just that their product caused damages of some type and they need to, you know, pay for those repercussions because of it. And so, you know, this is kind of like if I had a car and the brakes stopped working on the car, even though the company didn't know that their brakes were bad, they're still liable for the fact that they failed in the system, and there are potentially more failures across the board and more, you know, potentially a civil suit or a class action suit. And this enforces change in the corporations. So I think that if we really want to enforce this and push it forward, there should be a ton of civil suits that should come out of it if they can prove damages due to their products, due to their negligence of, you know, security patching and so on. And then that will force these companies to make even more changes because it's hurting their pocket as well as their as well as their commitment to this type of thing.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for that discussion. I'm sure we'll be back. This is an ongoing case. We'll find out what happens to the remaining 3 out of 6 charges against D-Link. This could be a bellwether for, the IoT going into the future. Well, folks, it's time for my favorite part of every episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's when we bring a guest in who can drop knowledge on the Twiat Riot, and we've got a great one for you. Let me welcome to the show Mr. Dave Signori from Infoblox. He runs strategy for network automation and discovery at that company. Now, he was a CTO of a network automation startup until it was acquired back in 2007. He owned the network automation and orchestration roadmap at that acquiring company until 2013, when he decided to move to Infoblox, where they were still investing in exciting things for the burgeoning network automation market. Mr. Signori, thank you very much for coming onto This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me, Father Robert. Good to be here.
You are on vacation right now, which kind of blows me away. You gave up some of your vacation time to be on our show?
Absolutely. I wouldn't miss this.
Well, thank you very much for that. And I'm glad to have you on the show because network automation is one of those topics that we bring up every once in a while. It gets people excited, and then it kind of falls off because it's still a little nebulous. We kind of understand what network automation is. We kind of understand the values. But what would be your 45-second pitch to an executive who maybe isn't that tech savvy? How would you convince him or her that network automation is something that that enterprise definitely needed to invest in?
Yeah, the reason you need to invest in it is because all the things that network automation does, like detecting change, making changes to network devices, ensuring that you have standardized configs, your network operations team is probably doing that today already, and they're using manual means or they're using scripting. And if you automate all that, you free them up to do much more strategic things. So the ROI analysis, you just save a ton of money because you're paying them to work on strategic things versus the day to day. So it's really an ROI thing.
Right. Yeah. Someone once gave me the layman's explanation of network automation. They said, well, imagine that you've got a bunch of screens. And if the screen turns red, then there's something wrong. And you have to pay people to watch the screen to see if it turns red, and then they report it to somebody else. With network automation, you have one person watching all the screens, and the network automation tells him or her what's gone wrong in the network. That's what you want. You want all of the scut work and all of the grunt work to be done by some sort of bot, by some sort of automation, so that the people who are skilled can actually be skilled.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So when you have the automation set up and something is detected that has gone wrong, like there's just a configuration error or default passwords are found somewhere on a network device, those can be corrected automatically. And then you're just notified, hey, we made this correction, right? But really where a lot of the ROI is in pushing changes out, right? It's not uncommon for our customers to do an update to 45,000 network devices of the local password or of a SNMP community name change. And if you were to do that with manual means or scripting, it would take you multiple weekends. And with automation, it's now done quickly and not in a manual fashion. So you're gaining ROI on that.
Okay, well, we have to back into that because I can't just say, oh, let's get rid of scripting, let's get rid of the CLI, let's get rid of manual input, because I am part of that generation that has muscle memory. I know all the commands. I know what I need to run. And I can do it relatively quickly. I mean, I can drill down through my networks and I can find out exactly what's wrong and I know exactly which script I need to run. Why do I need automation? How do you sell automation to me?
Right. So you can get in trouble with when you're just using CLI. I mean, first of all, you could just simply fat finger something, right? You remember the Amazon S3 down when it went down in March?
That was one keystroke. I think it was just one
keystroke.
Yeah,
right. That was brought down because of a fat finger, right? So because they weren't using automation, it was a CLI. But also, you might make a change that you forget to save, right? So the change gets lost when the network device reboots, right? You could be making changes in just different ways across different network devices, and you're not standardizing. Right. The leading cause to this day of any network problem that happens is still network change.
Yeah.
Right. And that can get you in trouble with the CLI. And as far as the scripting goes, a lot of times the scripting, you're writing it specifically for a particular type of device. Right. There's no standardization on that. And then you don't have record of the credentials you're supposed to use in a single spot. You don't have a record of what the configuration used to look like, right? You script it, it makes the change, but what did it used to look like? So if change is your leading cause of a problem, you obviously need to keep track of all the changes that happen on the network. So change happens, causes a problem. You go back to see what it used to look like. You can back that change out. Or at least you can go and see who the person was that made the change, who was the engineer, when they did it, and then you can have a conversation with them. So automating the change management is increasing your uptime and it's saving you money.
I love that you focus on change management, because that's even the name of change management. It acknowledges the fact that network architecture has matured to the point where we know it's going to work. We have all the pieces. We understand how they interlink together. And so if there's going to be something that goes wrong, it's typically a change that we made. And we need our tools to tell me, well, which change broke what thing?
Right.
But we do have in the chat room, we have Emily the Strange, who asked the question, when we automate things and things still go wrong, doesn't that add to the complexity of troubleshooting? I mean, if I'm manually putting in a script, I can pretty quickly figure out that I just did something wrong. But if I've got an automated system, I might not even know that it was a change that caused something until hours later.
Well, when you standardize enough, right, and if you really follow best practices, you would have a set of rules, internal standards, that a product like NetMRI can help you configure. And then when you standardize on those and you standardize on your scripts, then the chances of something going wrong decreases immensely. Now, sure, you might be able to, there may be a problem that might sneak through, but at least you have a record of exactly what the configuration used to look like, and you know exactly what changed. So if you do need to do a rollback, you can use the automation to roll back as well. So even though some people may say, I'm using automation, that could make the problem be much worse, right? It doesn't happen a whole lot because you're standardizing. And if it does happen, you can use automation to do the rollback also.
P.S. Chops in the chat room, I think, has nailed it, which is knowing best practices is one thing. Following best practices is another thing. And if you automate strongly, then you can automate the best practices. You don't have to you no longer have to worry about that one admin who thinks he knows better than everybody else and he knows the one command that's going to fix everything, and suddenly you've spread a bad change across your entire enterprise, which again has happened. Now let's back into the info block side of this, because specifically sure. Your product is called NetMRI. How is this different? I mean, there are change logs and there are change tools that we've played with before. What is it about NetMRI that makes info blocks think that this is the secret sauce?
Yeah. So there's probably three things I want to point out. First, InfoBlocks NetMRI does a broad superset of network automation functionality. If you were to compare it to other network change configuration management tools, it does more, right? So first of all, it has a full-blown, very deep discovery. So a lot of NCCM tools, network change configuration management, have to be fed what was discovered. It has discovery, and it feeds that discovery to InfoBlocks IP address management system, right? So most people hear InfoBlocks, they think, oh, they're the world leading vendor in DNS, DHCP, and IPAM, right? You probably didn't think we were going to talk about network automation today. You probably thought we were going to talk about DNS, right? We are the leading vendor, and this tool, NetMRI, feeds that system to make sure it's accurate. Because if your IPAM system isn't accurate, it's not doing you much value. Because that IPAM system is supposed to tell you whether something's in use or not and to make sure that it's true. NetMRI sees it on the network, make sure that it's true. So that's a key differentiator. Another one is that it does the change management. It does the scripting, the automation, right? So you can use your favorite scripting language. You can use our internal scripting language, and we standardize it using our job engine, right? It does configuration analysis. There's a ton of out-of-the-box checks that it makes without you having to configure anything at all. Like if you made a change that you didn't save, right? Or if, your HSRP pairs aren't configured correctly, that sort of thing. Or, and this is a key one, which may have helped out, at least the theory behind Equifax, is it detects when users, when you have default credentials set up on your systems or your network devices. Right? Remember, that was an admin password on that system that got hacked at Equifax. So little things like that, it does out of the box. And then lastly, the thing I want to point out is that because NetMRI knows of the entire state of everything on the network, and because you can configure policy rules about how things should be standardized, right, we use a feed from the network device vendors like Cisco, Juniper, InfoBlocks, F5, to tell us when vulnerability events, pcert events, lifecycle events come in, and then immediately alert the network operations team whether they're vulnerable to those. So that is a multi-vendor feed in real time to tell you whether you have something of a problem. And that, by the way, does lead me to that quick 30-second video that I loaded, because that'll give you a little bit of a view of what that looks like.
Yeah,
if you guys want to roll that.
Go ahead and roll that, Kevin, because let's find out what InfoBlocks has done with NetChange.
Chances are it's big, complex, growing, and constantly changing. Vulnerabilities in network devices are the main entry point for those seeking access to your network and systems. Keeping intruders out is key to protecting your corporate and customer data. Network vendors provide security advisory information and are constantly updating it. But how does your team make sense of this data? You need to determine which vulnerabilities impact your network's security posture and take timely action to keep your network secure. Empowered Advisor is an add-on subscription service that leverages the industry-leading Infoblox Net MRI system to automatically and continuously monitor your vendor's security advisory information, determine which advisories may affect you, and allow you to take action. To learn how Empowered Advisor can help you automatically secure your network, go to empowerednetworks.com/advisor. If you don't have Infoblox Net MRI yet, we can help with that too. Give Empowered a call at 1-877-325-1855 or go to empowerednetworks.com.
All right, so I'm glad that you brought IPAM into here because it did kind of answer that nagging question of why is Infoblox doing net change tools? But that does make sense. But so this Empowered system, give me a practical example of how this is going to work. So I'm an enterprise. Let's say I am running some Infoblox gear for my DNS.
Yep.
How do I use this to secure my network, and how do I use it to best protect it from its employees?
Right. There isn't a single network enterprise team out there that doesn't have this problem. So NetMRI has the knowledge of everything on the network, right? The Empowered Advisor monitors the RSS feed. Coming in from Cisco, coming in from Juniper, F5, Infoblox, they're adding new vendors all the time. So when Cisco announces a piece cert saying, hey, this model, this operating system has a vulnerability, immediately that is loaded into the NetMRI system and the administrators are notified. If you don't have that, right, then what, and every IT team is doing this, they periodically will go and check the Cisco piece certs, maybe by email, that sort of thing. They gather up the configs. They may meet on it once a week, once a month, once a quarter to see if they have an issue. Now that all that is automated, and every single network operations team is dealing with that. And then you can use NetMRI if you need to put an operating system patch or update the operating system, because it does the network automation too. You can use it to deploy, you know, the next operating system out to those 85 routers, 85 switches that needed that update. The other part of this, and again, everybody struggles with this, is life cycle. Cisco announces end of life, end of support, particular model, typical operating system, particular module, right? And then you've got to go figure out whether you have that on your network, so you need to replace it, or whether you want to decide whether you want to renew maintenance, right? That link comes in from the Empowered Advisor also. And right in the NetMRI user interface and in reports for every single network device you have out there, we have the end of life status. We have the end of life date. We have the end of sale date, all automated directly from the vendor.
All right. Okay. That makes sense. Now, of course, our audience, they are very tech savvy. Many of them work directly in IT fields where they will be designed, required to type in CLIs. What's your sell to them? Can you use some concrete examples that you might have of where the cost savings are going to come in? Because I know there's a lot of people who are saying, wait a minute, the CLI works just fine for me. I understand if I do something stupid, then I can cause a big problem. But as long as I follow best practices, as long as I know what I'm doing, why invest in what is an incredibly expensive, relatively, solution where I could just do it by myself? This is not the elevator pitch. This is the sit down with the engineer and say, look, let me make your job easier.
Yeah. So there's two things. One is, we don't prevent you from continuing to use the CLI if you want. NetMRI can act as a proxy, an SSH proxy. Engineer wants to use the command line interface he knows and loves, he can do that through the NetMRI appliance, and that engineer can use the terminal emulator they prefer, secure CRT, PuTTY, SSH. That goes through the appliance. It's barely any different than them accessing it directly. And then now their entire session gets recorded and logged, which means that if they want to go back and check to see what they typed, or if they want to copy that into a script or a template and then reuse it to push the change out to multiple devices, that's going to help them a lot. If their manager asks them, hey, go update these 30 routers over the weekend, if he's going to use CLI and not script, he's going to log in 30 times. Uses NetMRI, he writes the script once using the CLI. That script can have the CLI he knows and loves, pushes it out to those 30 devices with a single operation, and that engineer is done in 15 minutes instead of spending the whole weekend. So you can use it if you want, and then you can also reuse that command line interface in the scripting that we run out of our job engine.
You know, actually, I love that approach, because I have had network change tools, and one of the things that bothered me was just that, exactly that. I was accustomed to the CLI. I wasn't exactly sure if the automated tool was doing what I thought it was doing because I couldn't see it. If you give me the option to continue using the CLI with NetMRI as the proxy for me, and if higher up admin can make sure that I don't do anything stupid with that, then I can gradually work myself into using the automated tool. That I do like. Let me go ahead and bring my co-host back in here because we are starting to run towards the end of the episode. I want to make
sure.
Don't
forget to ask me about SDN. Don't forget to ask me about that.
That was Chiebert. Chiebert's going to be all up in the SDN. Chiebert, one of the things that really necessitated some sort of network change tool, not just made it a good option, was SDN, because now it's not just easy to fat finger a switch. It's now easy to completely destroy your network if you don't know how you're using the CLI. We didn't really test this out at Interop, right? We never pushed SDN to that point.
No, we actually kind of did. It was purely by mistake. We had one person that made a change and went to lunch and took down a large portion of the Interop net, thankfully, before the show floor opened. So that's actually a good support for why a change management system is so necessary as things get more complicated. When you're starting to deal with a software-defined network and one little change could make a big, big impact, or even let's go back a little bit. Even if we're dealing with BGP, you know, we've seen some really stunning BGP errors take down large portions of the internet because someone made a change and didn't realize that someone else had made a change beforehand. Being able to coordinate that makes a big difference. So my question to Dave is, nobody can afford to do forklift upgrades anymore. How do we ease in? Can NetMRI actually help me integrate my legacy gear with the new gear?
Yes, absolutely. So this would be a good time to flash that other image because what happened, so when the NCCM tools first came out back in the mid-2000s, right, they sold well. And then there was this promise of software-defined networking. And a lot of shops were like, you know, that's what we're going to go with. That's that's the silver bullet. And the NCCM sales kind of dropped off there. But SDN did not deliver. And it's been slow in the rollout, and it's been very challenging. We are just beginning to see it now, though. Right, we're beginning to see controllers show up. You're beginning to see folks are beginning to use Cisco's data center software-defined networking, which is the Cisco ACI, the application-centric infrastructure on the APIC controller. And so the way to ease in, right, is to have a tool, a network change config management tool that's future-proof, right? And what I mean future-proof is that in this example, in this image, this customer, for instance, is still maybe using equipment that requires to be managed in a legacy or traditional way, right? In my graphic here, I've got Palo Alto, I've got F5, other vendors, right? I mean, NetMRI supports like 65 different vendors of tools out there. And traditionally, we may need to hit them using CLI, using SNMP, that sort of thing. But now you can drop in an SDN controller like ACI, and then we are giving you a common view, right? A common view of the change management, right, future proof, so that you can drop SDN and slowly move to it, and still have the visibility and the change management from a single tool. So it wasn't just that we're getting that SDN data from Cisco ACI; we're also understanding these new software-defined networking objects that you're seeing there, like endpoint groups, EPGs, tenants, application profiles. So if you are looking at a network automation tool, make sure it's future-proof. And when I say future-proof as the product manager, I'm meaning helping my customers slowly move into that environment. And I talk to one almost every day who is in the process of doing what Brian just asked, right? Hey, we're moving to a Viptela on the SD-WAN. We're moving to Aruba Cloud Control. Can you help us get there? And each one of our releases, we move in that direction so that we can support that network as you make that transition.
Got it, right. Okay, so I want to go to Lou in just a bit because Lou seems to be aching with a question. I can see him in my preview monitor. But before we get there, I do want to cover this just a tiny bit more. You are giving me a tool that can help me to see when, not just when I've made changes in my network, but when I should make changes in my network. My question to you is, well, do I need Infoblox gear exclusively throughout my network to make this work? This has been a question that's been running through the chat room. What do I have to do to run this on my network? What's my start costs?
Well, if you're going to run this particular solution, right, then, I mean, if you're asking for pricing, I mean the way we price is basically by network device that we're managing. Okay. The more network devices, then the higher the price goes up. But at certain thresholds, the per network device price drops, right? But you're also getting the added value of the discovery, because we are discovering and showing you all of the end hosts. We're not counting those. You're going to see all your end hosts, your workstations show up, even though you're only paying on a per network device management. And then you're paying for the appliances that are going in. I mean, it's your choice. You could certainly script and run the risk that we talked about. You could go with a lower cost solution that doesn't come with appliances, or, you know, I could probably name five off the top of my head if you want, that just comes as software, only runs in Windows, that sort of thing, right? But it's gonna run into limitations. It's gonna run into limitations in scale. It's gonna run into limitations on the flexibility of the policy engine. It's gonna run into limitations of being future proof as the network vendors are rolling out software-defined networking architectures. If you want to hit me offline, I can give you an idea roughly of the price. I don't like to talk for my sales folks.
No, I understand.
But we license this by per network device.
We actually prefer it that way. We don't necessarily want the salespeople on the show. They can handle everything afterwards.
Right.
It works a bit better that way. Lou, did you have a question?
Yeah, so one question I had is, you kind of talked a little bit about this, about bringing data in from other scenarios in order to make better use out of it. And I think that's a lot of when networks are expanding and servers are expanding, and, you know, is this solution able to bring in and work with potentially other pieces of data that would help you understand not just network appliances? Like, for instance, if I had a set of devices, or, you know, bring my own device on the network that are producing issues within the network itself, and I need to know, you know, what kind of device it is and all that kind of thing. Is this is I can ingest and report on this data as well?
Yeah. So this particular product is, as I mentioned earlier, a great deep discovery engine. So not only are we discovering every network device, and then we're telling you serial number, operating system model, we also are telling you the attached end hosts, so your Windows boxes, your Macs, your Linux servers, telling you the operating system, those. And then we're also telling you which access point on the wireless network they're attached to, which switch port they're attached to. So we're giving you all that context and all that extra knowledge. Now, when you pair this with some of the other Infoblox products, right, this is how Infoblox does this integration, right? Something like along the lines of Infoblox's DNS firewall. The DNS firewall knows when, for instance, there's malware on an end host that tries to call out to a blacklisted site, right? That can signal NetMRI to quarantine that end host, right? Now we're using the automation to go right back to that switch port and putting in a quarantine VLAN or disabling the switch port, that sort of thing. Example of an automation. Another one is NetMRI discovers a new subnet, new IP address, right? We have integrations that can be sent out to vulnerability scanners like Qualys, Rapid7, Tenable, that will immediately trigger it to start a scan, so that you're lessening the amount of time a potential compromised end host can be on the network, right? So the whole purpose there is full visibility, everything you just asked about, right? And then adding some automation to that across a broader ecosystem.
So let me actually, I'm glad that you brought in the partnerships, because that was really my next question. For the automation, it's nice to know the change, but it's also nice to know that the automation can be set up to automatically address those changes. And of course, the biggest one is a device comes into my network, a new network comes into my network, and a rogue AP comes into my network. I want to know that the tool is smart enough not just to notify me that that change has been made, but also perhaps to kick off some partner suites, either from Infoblox or your third parties, that can deal with that without intervention. Could you give me a scenario? Let's say, let me give you the hypothetical 10,000 seat enterprise. I've got a new user. Maybe my new user hasn't read our acceptable use policy. Maybe he or she doesn't care what's in the AUP, but they come on and they bring a phone, a laptop, a tablet. It doesn't authenticate immediately. So they tried to plug in a rogue AP so that they can get wireless, like just like they do at home. What will my IT people see? And what will NetMRI do to make that not affect the overall network?
Yeah. So there's two things there. One is if an IP comes up, right, NetMRI detects it, sends it up to our IPAM system, and our IPAM system is supposed to know, the administrators are supposed to know every IP address, whether it's in use or not, or whether it's in a DHCP range, that sort of thing. NetMRI sends the IP address up, and an IPAM says, hey, this is unmanaged, right? We flag it. It's an unmanaged address. Some policy has been broken here. And notifications can go out, and then the administrator has a decision to make. He can quarantine it, meaning send network automation events down to the switch to quarantine it, send an event to network access control. We have out-of-the-box integration, for instance, with Cisco ICE to quarantine the end host. Or he may just decide, this is legitimate, so I'm going to convert this to a fixed address. I'm going to put it in a DHCP range. I'm going to put it into a DNS object, that sort of thing. That's one thing. The other thing we can do is we do detect when, for instance, someone hooked up a home switch or a home hub, whatever, up to the network, right? We have ways of seeing, oh, we have two end hosts on this switch link that is only supposed to have one. And so alerts would occur. So we can either alert and or correct it ourselves and or send it to another ecosystem to take corrective action.
So one other question I had is in regard to if I want to you talked a little bit about licensing and how big your network is and, you know, kind of the costs of kind of getting started. You know, where do people go? When do people know they need to start using these tools? I think what are the kind of the signals in the system that they say, hey, I need to start using this stuff?
Yeah, so one obviously, and we get this all the time, is there will be an outage, and it would be due to a change that was made, and they'll realize that they didn't have the controls in place. They went to this FTP server where the backup configs were supposed to be getting stored, like an engineer was supposed to store the backup, make the change, right, and then have the backup in case the change caused a problem, and they just weren't doing it. And then when something like that happens and an outage happens at a site, that's when the VP will say it's time to start automating this. So let's round up, let's put an RFI out there and take a look at what some of the NCCM vendors are doing. Another one is reporting on compliance. It's pretty much standard knowledge now that if you standardize on your configuration settings for internal standards, or you may just be required to pass an audit, right? Financial customers have to pass a PCI audit. Health is for HIPAA audit, right? Government will be DISA-STIG, DOD, that type of audit. They need to automate running that report. So the network, being able to check those things and show an auditor very quickly and easily becomes very valuable. Because if they're not doing that, the amount of time they're spending collecting the configs, checking against all the hundreds of rules they need to, and then generating a report is way too expensive, and they just want to save money by automating on that.
So I got a real fast question. All this is great. Can I actually use this to capture my organizational knowledge and provide it in a way that I could use it for, say, training the new kid on the block?
Well, you can certainly use it to, because when a lot of people write their rules, their internal rules, they want to capture what's currently out there. So they gather it all up, they take a look at it, and they say, all right, this looks good. This is what we're going to make as a standard. They can either gather the configs and or they can run searches to say, hey, how is the typical way we have XYZ configured? And now let's standardize on that. The other way is organizational knowledge on doing new device provisioning, right? A brand new device goes out. Ideally, they're provisioning it the same way every time. And they'll have gold standard templates. It'll just be some text file sitting on someone's machine, right? And in order to bring that into a system, now you're making it available to the whole network operations, network engineering team. It's not tribal knowledge. You're doing it as a part of the system. So being able to gather that up and convert it into standards is something that I see a lot.
All right. We are actually out of time, but I do want to give you a little bit of time towards the end here to sell our audience, not on the service, not on the product itself, but on this idea. if they want to find out more about InfoBlox, maybe if they want to take it for a test drive, that's great. But if they're not yet convinced that automation is the way to go, that they need to start stepping in this direction, what would you say to them?
So I would say that there isn't a single network operations team I've talked about there that doesn't want to automate more next year than they are this year, right? If you take a look at the amount of time that you're spending doing things and think about it for a second on if I could free that up, right, so I could work on something else, right, when would that be the time where it makes sense to use automation instead? The other thing I would recommend is make sure if you are going to choose a tool that it's future-proof. So if you make the goal of I want to automate more changes and I want to make it future-proof, right, then all I ask is ask those two questions before you go and take a look at a network automation tool.
We've been speaking with Dave Signori of InfoBlox. He's a Senior Director of Product Management, Network Automation, and Discovery. I want to thank you so much for coming on to this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. This has been a request for quite a while from the Twight, right? They wanted change control, and I think this is a very, very good glimpse into a very good solution. Now, let's throw them to a link. If they wanted to find out more about InfoBlox and you, where do they go?
Yeah, so if you go to the product page for NetMRI at infoblox.com, yeah, you can get a demo. I can download an eval if you want there, right? If you just go to the @DaveSignori, you can hit my Twitter, my LinkedIn. I do a monthly NetMRI webinar that if you want an invite to that, drop me an email and you'll get it. We do the 20-minute presentation. We do a 40-minute detailed demo. Every month we do it. We record it. And we either change the topics a little bit. We have repeat attendees come back and say, that was a great overview. Next month, could you focus on compliance, right? And the month after that, maybe let's talk about focusing on using it to push automated changes out, right? NetMRI does have a technical advisory board, right? We have hundreds of customers. And our top and heavy users meet with me once a quarter, and we talk about the industry trends and what needs to happen. So if you're scratching your head thinking about becoming a customer, just keep that in mind that we spend a lot of time, talking with our customers and investing in the product. So the whole goal there is to be future-proof.
Dave, again, thank you, and thank you for your time with This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Hey, thanks for having me. I had a blast. Appreciate it.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour of your time listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 ignored best practices documents. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host. Chibert, let's start with you. What are you up to aside from melting, and where can people find you in the coming days?
Actually, I think I'm going to go and download a copy of NetMRI and see how well it works with the underwater observatory, because man, oh man, change management is a bummer. And if someone makes a goof 3 miles underwater, that's a heck of a service call.
I was about to say, change management at 3 miles under, isn't that normally just, oh, your network has imploded?
Yeah. Anyway, so I'm ADVNETLAB on Twitter, and I am also Chibert at twit.tv. And thank you to the Twight Riot for this amazing subject suggestion.
Indeed. And of course, we have to thank our very own booth babe, Lou Maresca. I like saying that phrase. I don't know. You know what? It reminds me of the old days of Comdex, really. But you are going to be a fantastic booth representative from Microsoft at Ignite. When does that start? Monday?
Sign up is Sunday. And then, yeah, all the events and the keynotes and everything start on Monday.
I have to say, I'm feeling a little bit jelly. I wish I could make it down there. I do one or two Orlando events every year. I just couldn't make this one. If you could please tell the Twight right where they can find you, of course, on your Twitter address. Maybe invite them to meet up with you at Ignite, at least to the Mary Jo and Paul beer thingy. But they need to have that information.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, maybe if you want to check out, we have a Ignite pre-day that's going on Sunday that will it's doing Office Dev and Microsoft Office scenarios. So check that out if you want to come see and have like a little intimate session with us and going through some development of some of the processes. And of course, you can always come out to the meetup, which is at the World of Beer on Dr. Phillips Boulevard. I think that's at 6 p.m. on Tuesday this coming week, where Mary Jo and Paul Thurrott and the whole clan will be there. So come out and see us, and you can always check me out on Twitter. I'll be kind of doing that from the show floor and from my booth at Lou MM.
And you know what? I'll say this. If you go to the meetup, get a picture of Paul, Mary Jo, and Lou all together with their beers, and if you send it to me on Twitter, you will win a free supply, lifetime supply of spam email. So again, you can hit me at padre@twit.tv. Folks, thank you so very, very much. Chibert, Lou, I wouldn't do the show without you. And I also wouldn't do the show without you. That's right. I'm reaching into the camera right now. I'm reaching into my mic. And I'm looking at the people who have come back week after week, year after year, to watch and listen to This Week in Enterprise Tech. We wouldn't have a show without you, without our faithful listeners, without our loyal audience. It's because of you that we've been able to bring you all the enterprise goodness possible for all these years here on the Twit TV network. We want to make it a little easier for you to get all the content and to support the show. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/twiet. There you'll find all of our back episodes, all the way to episode one, as well as the notes for every single one of our shows. If you want to find the link to one of the stories that we spoke about, if you want to see the name of the guest and how you contact him or her and their company, again, just go to twit.tv/twiet. And as long as you're there, why not subscribe? This is the best way to support the show and to make sure that you never miss an episode. You can get an audio version, a video version, or a high-definition video version. And it's also a really good place to share the content with your friends. Again, if you want to support the show, twit.tv/twiet. Also, don't forget that you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me there, you'll find out what I'm doing when I'm not here doing shows for Twit TV, like this, for example, which is The Destruction of the World and Civilization, is it six or six? I can't even remember. I had to stop playing Civilization because there were too many nights where I stopped playing when the sun was coming up. But again, go to twitter.com/PadreSJ and follow me. Finally, thanks to everyone here at the studio who makes the show possible, to Lisa and Leo, who have allowed us to continue doing This Week in Enterprise Tech, to Burke and John and Alex, the engineers who make sure everything works, and of course, to my TD, Kevin. TD, Kevin. Super Kevin. Now, Kevin, you know that this is the time of the show where you get some redemption. I ask you some questions from the knowledge of the episode, and you try to get it right. Are you ready for this one?
No.
Okay, what specifically is InfoBlox most famous for in the year 2017?
Blocking info.
I'm sorry. No. The answer was gelato. They make killer gelato. Kevin, maybe next time we'll try to have you back here on the show. Folks, until then, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep twiet.